I am honored to be able to share a little bit here, and this will be kind of a illustrated version of the Buddha's life. The fact that it's visual means that it has visual components, so it's that lens. And as some of you know, this is India, and most of the Buddha's life happened up in this area here in the Ganges Valley, right sort of just south of the mountains, but in the whole big flat area here. And in where I'm pointing now, Bodhgaya is where he was enlightened, and Sravasti is where the right near where he was, how he grew up. So a different map here, show it a little better. So he was, and we'll go through these points, but I just want to, you can imprint on him a little bit. He was born up here in Lumbini, which is Nepal, grew up in the Sravasti area, was awakened in Bodh Gaya. The first teaching was in Sarnath, which is outside of Varanasi, died in Kushinagar. So most of the time he was, over the 40 years that he taught, he went back and forth pretty much in this area. It's about 350 miles from here to there. So he was moving back and forth, spent a lot of time around here and quite a bit of time around here and sort of in between. So he went mostly on foot. This was 2,600 years ago, teaching the Dharma to people he met. And at that time, it wasn't really India. It was the intersection of three neighboring and sometimes warring kingdoms, the Magadhan, the Kosala, and the Vaijin Republic. In his 80-year life, has some key areas. So here we are, starting with Lumbini. And this is, again, just over the border into Nepal. And this structure here covers some archaeological remains of where he was born. Now, Kapilavastu was the capital of his father's small kinglet where he grew up, and also the location of Jetavana Monastery, which we'll be talking about later. I realize I made one mistake. I mean, I just turned the mic order. So this is the Mahadevi temple, I meant to say. And now we're in Kapilavastu. And this is where his father, who was royalty in the Sakyan clan, had hoped the Buddha would be in his footsteps and also rule the kingdom. So in the suttas, the Buddha describes in great detail the delicacy of his life. He wore only fine silks from Varanasi. He lived in three castles, palaces according to the season, and he was entertained by only female dancers and singers. So perhaps this structure was one of those palaces. And it was during this period, as a child, that the Buddha had a spiritual opening under a rose apple tree, which was very important in terms of how his practice evolved. And Lauren will be describing this time and greater event later. So the Buddha was in this opulence for the time, but he gradually saw through the transitory and unsatisfactory nature of all these attainments, and he left the palace and his wife and child to go on a spiritual quest in his 30s. And for 6 years, he wandered through India, and this period included a long period of extreme asceticism. You don't see many of these statues, but they're here and there in temples in Asia. And the Buddha's body was so starved that he could touch his backbone from the front. His eyes were sunken into his head, he said. His hair was coming out. And he was teetering on the edge of death. But it was at this moment that he had the vision about the rose apple, and he started eating again. And this was the beginning of what has come to be known as the middle way. So at the end of this ascetic period, after 6 years, he awakened under the Bodhi tree, which is now in Bodh Gaya. By the way, these photos are about two-thirds or three-quarters are from two pilgrimages I did to India, and then some of the rest are from Wiki Commons. So his awakening, so this tree you can see here, surrounded by pilgrims from all different cultures, and there are some Westerners usually popping up here and there. This tree is a descendant of the original Bodhi tree that was cut down at some point by a anti-Buddhist leader, and then this was regrown from a sapling. So there's a real sense of continuity here. And the night of his awakening was a battle with Mara, who sort of symbolizes all of his graspings and confusions, and he had to struggle and come face to face with everything. He was tempted in every way imaginable, everything from lust with dancing maidens in front of him to fear with legions of warriors against him, all in his mind, perhaps. But he sat under this tree and awakened. And this is the Mahabodhi stupa, on the trees on the back side of it. And this is like the pilgrimage place for Buddhists from all over the world, this whole complex. And it's just amazing to be there because you just cross paths with everybody. And if you're there, you're pretty much a practitioner. There are some Indian tourists, but it's a beautiful place. And the depth of this commitment, you can see with these, you can see that. The monastics there, this monastic here is praying, and there's just a lot of people practicing and meditating, and you can see way back here, there's people circumambulating on this level, and then people circumambulating on this level, and then also up here right around the building itself. So it's just a lot of activity, and it's just a very serene, beautiful place. So within weeks after he was awakened, he realized that there were people with little dust in their eyes. And so the Buddha looked for people, someone he could teach, and he ended up walking the 150 miles northwest to Sarnath, which at that point was also called Deer Park. It was just a place outside, about 5 miles outside of the holy city of Varanasi, which in Hinduism is the most ancient and most holy city in India. So it was here that he taught the first, started to teach the Dharma. It's known as the first turning of the wheel. And for many centuries, the very first teaching he gave to his first five disciples was marked by a massive, it's called the Dharmajika Stupa, which was right here. Sadly, it was torn down in the 18th century for building materials by a local Maharaj. So all that's left of this stupa is this disc. But this is the first teaching. The second teaching in Sarnath was at the Dhammek Stupa, where he taught what's called the Anatta Dhaka Kana Sutta, which is about the Buddhist idea of not self. And I should have said in the first teaching, he taught about the Four Noble Truths and about the Middle Way, because he's teaching to his five ascetics and basically suggesting to them that there was something between starving yourself to death and gluttony, which was just taken care of. And this is a site that attracts pilgrims from all over the world. And over many centuries, monastics built all kinds of monasteries at the site of Sarnath. So that's went on for many, many, many centuries, largely destroyed by invaders in the 13th century. But up until then, this was a great, great center of practice. The third teaching he gave, and there's only three in succession that are numbered like this, was called the Fire Sermon. Some of you may know of that, where he said everything is burning. And it was given on Gaya Hill, which is outside of Bogaya. It's about 5 miles away. And it's interesting that he was learning how to relate to people. So the people he was teaching there had formerly been matted hair ascetics and Hinduism fire worshippers. So he used the metaphors of fire to communicate with them. It's very powerful. Powerful bit there. So now I'm going to just kind of hang out. I showed you that range, that 350 mile range. So in the eastern end of it, a little bit to the north of Bodh Gaya, is Vulture Peak. And some of you may have, especially if you've done Mahayana practice, this is where he gave the famous Heart Sutra. But it's also mentioned in suttas a lot. And he practiced up in Vulture Peak, and it's up there. I mean, this way down here, that's the parking lot, and it's a trail. It's like a hike to get up there. If you ever do it, by the way, get there really early in the morning because there's tons of pilgrims. But he did a lot of practice there, and then just below Vulture Peak, like 100 feet, just around a corner, this is called the Boar's Cave, and this is where Sariputta, one of the Buddha's two chief disciples, awakened. So this is a very sacred place in its own right. And for those of you who have read the suttas, you'll see different names, like some of you may see the mango grove mentioned. And this is the mango grove, and it's only like a 30-minute drive away from the bottom of Vulture Peak. And this was donated by the physician, the doctor of King Bimbisara. And King Bimbisara was one of the Buddha's main patrons, and King Bimbisara donated the bamboo grove, which is this. So you'll see that mentioned a lot. But the Buddha kept being drawn back to his homeland, about 350 miles to the west, and more than any one place, he practiced and taught at Jetavana Monastery here in Sravasti, which is near where he grew up. And this was given to him by Anapanatika, who covered the land with gold, it's written, to create this place. And it's just an extraordinary place. And, you know, to be anywhere in India where there aren't any people and you're not hassled or no beggars, it's amazing. So you can practice there. It's way up in Uttar Pradesh, really hard to get to, 50 kilometers from the nearest railroad station. And it's here that the Buddha completed 24 rains retreats. And this is the retreat done during the monsoon in India, which is kind of our same time as our summer. And they did rains retreats then, partly because it was raining and partly so the monks would trample on people's planted fields. And in the suttas, this monastery is mentioned over and over and over again, because the suttas normally say where it happened. There's 871 suttas were offered here over many, many years. So this does bring pilgrims, like this group of Sri Lankans who are building this extraordinary wheel of Dharma from marigold petals, which they must have rehearsed because they did it so fast and it was really hot. And they had spray bottles to keep them fresh. It was just an amazing thing they did. So, but not so many pilgrims, it's hard to get to. So nothing like the masses of pilgrims at Bodh Gaya. This is the site where the Buddha had his hut. Actually, there's two of them, but this is the main one. And of course, it wasn't all made of bricks like this. It got turned into that and then restored by the Indian government. But nonetheless, something like this was built to commemorate where his hut was. And so that's kind of extraordinary to think of that, that he walked back and forth here. And this is a little stupa that people have covered with gold leaf. And this is called the Mulaganda Kikuti. This was his hut at Sravasti. And also at the site is pilgrims come. So here's some pilgrims, and here's some monks that are teaching them. So it's a constant stream of people offering flowers and all kind of offering at that hut and all over this site. And there is a descendant of the Bodhi tree here also, some kind of clipping. And it's great veneration. And there's also this area is the site of the striking story of Angulimala, who is perhaps the world's first serial killer. This is the veneration of the Bodhi tree. Now we have the stupa of Angulimala. And of course, you could wonder, if the guy's the first serial killer, why is there a stupa? Lauren will explain this to you. And the Buddha's life ended in Kushinagar, which is halfway between the two major areas. He was traveling, he was 80, his body was breaking down. He said it was like a ox cart held together with leather straps falling apart. And it's a difficult time. The kingdoms were at war, Bimbisara had been deposed, King Panaseta, if I pronounce that right, the other king of Magadha had been deposed, both by their sons. Both of his chief disciples had died. It was not an easy time. There was pain in his life, but not suffering because he was awakened. So Kushinagar, it's an amazing place. And you can see there's foundations of monasteries here too. This is a stupa commemorating his death. And this building here holds a statue of the reclining Buddha that was buried for centuries, 36 feet long. just an amazing thing. And it's just, it was a sort of great reverence and depth going on in this building. I hunkered myself in one of those corners for a whole day, and just these waves of pilgrims would come through in these buses, and it'd be packed and then empty and then packed and then empty. And people would bring these shawls and pull them over the statue. Some of them were all embroidered. They must have done it back in their home country. So it was just beautiful. And even at the end of his life, very end of his life, he continued to express compassion. He made sure that Kunda, who was a goldsmith, who made the Buddha's very last meal, and he made one particular dish that perhaps it was poison, perhaps it was bad, but Buddha got food poisoning and said no one else should eat this. But he was very careful to make sure, to pull Kunda aside and said, no, you did nothing bad. This is how a Buddha's life ends. So he's very kind. And then at the very end, he was sick, he was near death, and this wandering mendicant, Subhada, appeared out of nowhere and said, oh my God, the Buddha's dying. Please give me teachings. And of course, Ananda, his attendant, Buddha's attendant, said, no, leave him alone. But the Buddha overheard, and he said, no, have him come. And so he gave Subhada teachings at the very last hour. And the Buddha's final words were, all things are impermanent. Strive for the goal with diligence. This stupa was built on the site of his cremation at Kanishagara. And of course, speaking of impermanence, it is more like a pile of bricks now than a stupa. And this half smile on the statue kind of captures that, the poignance, the impermanence, the great presence of the Buddha.